Belgian patriot. They viewed the note as an affront to Belgian honour. How could they have done otherwise? 1 hour later, at 9 p.m, the German ultimatum was discussed by the Council of Ministers and then by a Crown Council, at which the portfolio ministers were joined by a number of distinguished statesmen with titular ministerial titles. There was no debate. It was clear from the outset that Belgium would resist. During the hours of darkness, the Ministry of Foreign Affairs composed a reply of profoundly impressive dignity and clarity, culminating in a high-minded rejection of the German offer. The Belgian government, were they to accept the proposal submitted to them, would sacrifice the honour of the nation and betray at the same time their duties towards Europe. On the morning of the 3rd of August, the texts of the ultimatum and of the Belgian reply were shown to the French minister in Brussels, Monsieur Klobuchowski, who immediately passed the news to the Havas agency. A media storm swept through Belgium and the Entente countries, stirring outrage everywhere. In Belgium, there was an explosion of patriotic emotion. Across Brussels and other major towns, the streets filled with national flags. All the parties, from the anti-clerical liberals and socialists across to the clerical Catholics, pledged their determination to defend their homeland and their national honour against the invader. At the Chamber of Deputies, where the King spoke on the 5th of August of the need for national unity in defence of the fatherland, and asked the assembled deputies, "Are you determined at any cost to maintain the sacred heritage of our ancestors?" there was delirious cheering from all sides. The German ultimatum thus turned out to be a terrible psychological blunder. It resonated in wartime propaganda, overshadowing the complexities of the war's causation and endowing the Entente war effort with an unshakable sense of moral superiority. Many Germans were shocked by the Belgian decision to resist à l'outrance. "Oh, the poor fools," one diplomat at the German legation in Brussels exclaimed. "Oh, the poor fools! Why don't they get out of the way of the steamroller? We don't want to hurt them, but if they stand in our way, they will be ground into the dirt. Oh, the poor fools!" It was perhaps because they recognized this that the Germans renewed their appeal to Belgian reason only 6 days later, on the 8th of August. The fortress of Liège, so important to Moltke, had in the meanwhile been taken after a determined defence at considerable cost in life. In a note passed to Brand Whitlock, the American minister in Brussels, the Berlin government expressed its regret at the bloody encounters before Liège, and added, "Now that the Belgian army has upheld the honour of its arms by its heroic resistance to a very superior force, the German government beg the King of the Belgians and the Belgian government to spare Belgium the further horrors of war. Germany once more gives her solemn assurance that it is not her intention to appropriate Belgium to herself, and that such an intention is far from her thoughts. Germany is still ready to evacuate Belgium as soon as the state of war will allow her to do so." This offer, too, was rejected. Boots. With the sequence of general mobilizations, ultimatums, and declarations of war, the story this book set out to tell comes to an end. During his last meeting with Sazonov in St. Petersburg on Saturday, the 1st of August, Ambassador Portales muttered incomprehensible words, burst into tears, stammered, "So this is the result of my mission," and ran from the room. When Count Lichnowsky called on Asquith on the 2nd, he found the Prime Minister quite broken, with tears coursing down his cheeks. In Brussels, the departing councillors of the German legation sat on the edge of their chairs in a shuttered room among their packed boxes and files, mopping their brows and chain-smoking to master their agitation. The time of diplomacy was drawing to a close. The time of the soldiers and sailors had begun. When the Bavarian military plenipotentiary to Berlin visited the German Ministry of War after the order for mobilization had gone out, he found everywhere beaming faces, shaking of hands in the corridors. One congratulates oneself for having taken the hurdle. In Paris on the 30th of July, Colonel Ignatieff reported the unconcealed joy of his French colleagues at having the chance to use, as the French think, beneficial strategic circumstances. The First Sea Lord, Winston Churchill, was cheered by the thought of the impending struggle. "Everything tends towards catastrophe and collapse," he wrote to his wife on the 28th of July. "I am interested, geared up, and happy." In St. Petersburg, a jovial Alexander Krivoshein assured a delegation of Duma deputies that Germany would soon be crushed and that the war was a boon for Russia. "Depend upon us, gentlemen. Everything will be superb." Mansell Merry, vicar of St. Michael's, Oxford, had travelled to St. Petersburg in mid-July in order to officiate over the summer months as chaplain at the city's English church. When the order to mobilise was announced, he tried to make his escape by steamer to Stockholm. But his ship, the Durban, was confined to harbour. The lighthouses had been extinguished along the whole length of the Finnish Bight, and the forts at Kronstadt had been ordered to fire at once on any boat that attempted to pass the minefield. On the 31st of July, an ugly, grey, blustery day in St. Petersburg, Merry found himself confined on board with all the other would-be travellers, watching throngs of soldiers and naval reservists tramp along the Nikolaevskaya Quay. A few marched to the lilting strains of a brass band, but most trudged along, bundle on back or in hand, in sullen silence, the womenfolk, many of them weeping as if their hearts would break, breathlessly struggling to keep pace with their husbands, sons, or lovers on either side, as company after company swung past. In the small hours of the night of the 1st to the 2nd of August, the Boulevard du Palais in central Paris was filled with the same sound of marching men making their way in long columns northwards to the Gare de l'Est and du Nord. There was no music, singing, or cheering, just the scraping of boots, the clip-clopping of hundreds of horses, the growl of motor lorries, and the crunching of iron wheels on cobbles as artillery pieces rolled under the unlit windows of apartments, many of whose occupants must have lain awake or sleepily watched the sombre spectacle from their windows. Public reactions to the news of war gave the lie to the claim, so often voiced by statesmen, that the hands of the decision-makers were forced by popular opinion. There was, to be sure, no resistance against the call to arms. Almost everywhere, men went more or less willingly to their assembly points. Underlying this readiness to serve was not enthusiasm for war as such, but a defensive patriotism, for the etiology of this conflict was so complex and strange that it allowed soldiers and civilians in all the belligerent states to be confident that theirs was a war of defence, that their countries had been attacked or provoked by a determined enemy, that their respective governments had made every effort to preserve the peace. As the great alliance blocs prepared for war, the intricate chain of events that had sparked the conflagration was swiftly lost from view. "Nobody seems to remember," an American diplomat in Brussels noted in his diary on the 2nd of August, "that a few days ago Serbia was playing a star role in this affair. She seems to have faded away behind the scenes." There were isolated expressions of chauvinist enthusiasm for the coming fight, but these were the exception. The myth that European men leapt at the opportunity to defeat a hated enemy has been comprehensively dispelled. In most places, and for most people, the news of mobilization came as a profound shock, a peal of thunder out of a cloudless sky. And the further one moved away from the urban centres, the less sense the news of mobilization seemed to make to the people who were going to fight, die, or be maimed or bereaved in the coming war. In the villages of the Russian countryside, a stunned silence reigned, broken only by the sound of men, women, and children weeping. In Vatilieu, a small commune in the Rhône-Alpes region of southeastern France, the ringing of the tocsin brought workers and peasants into the village square. Some, who had run straight from the fields, were still carrying their pitchforks. "What can it mean? What is going to happen to us?" asked the women. Wives, children, husbands, all were overcome by emotion. The wives clung to the arms of their husbands. The children, seeing their mothers weeping, started to cry too. All around us was alarm and consternation. What a disturbing scene. An English traveller recalled the reaction in an Altai Semipalatinsk Cossack settlement when the blue flag, borne aloft by a rider and the noise of bugles playing the alarm, brought news of mobilization. The Tsar had spoken, and the Cossacks, with their unique military calling and tradition, burned to fight the enemy. But who was that enemy? Nobody knew. The mobilization telegram provided no details. Rumors abounded. At first, everyone imagined that the war must be with China. Russia had pushed too far into Mongolia, and China had declared war. Then another rumor did the rounds. It is with England. With England. This view prevailed for some time. Only after 4 days did something like the truth come to us, and then nobody believed it. Conclusion. I shall never be able to understand how it happened, the novelist Rebecca West remarked to her husband as they stood on the balcony of Sarajevo Town Hall in 1936. It was not, she reflected, that there were too few facts available, but that there were too many. That the crisis of 1914 was complex has been one of the central contentions of this book. Some of that intricacy derived from behaviors that are still part of our political scene. The last section of the book was written at the height of the Eurozone financial crisis of 2011-12, a present-day event of baffling complexity. It was notable that the actors in the Eurozone crisis, like those of 1914, were aware that there was a possible outcome that would be generally catastrophic, the failure of the euro. All the key protagonists hoped that this would not happen, but in addition to this shared interest, they also had special and conflicting interests of their own. Given the interrelationships across the system, the consequences of any one action depended on the responsive actions of others, which were hard to calculate in advance because of the opacity of decision-making processes. And all the while, political actors in the Eurozone crisis exploited the possibility of the general catastrophe as leverage in securing their own specific advantages. In this sense, the men of 1914 are our contemporaries. But the differences are as significant as the commonalities. At least the government ministers charged with solving the Eurozone crisis agreed in general terms on what the problem was. In 1914, by contrast, a profound sundering of ethical and political perspectives eroded consensus and sapped trust. The powerful supranational institutions that today provide a framework for defining tasks, mediating conflicts, and identifying remedies were conspicuously absent in 1914. Moreover, the complexity of the 1914 crisis arose not from the diffusion of powers and responsibilities across a single politico-financial framework, but from rapid-fire interactions among heavily armed autonomous power centers, confronting different and swiftly changing threats and operating under conditions of high risk and low trust and transparency. Crucial to the complexity of the events of 1914 were rapid changes in the international system, the sudden emergence of an Albanian territorial state, the Turco-Russian naval arms race in the Black Sea, or the reorientation of Russian policy away from Sofia to Belgrade, to name just a few. These were not long-term historical transitions, but short-term realignments. Their consequences were amplified by the fluidity of the power relations within the European executives. Grey's struggle to contain the threat posed by the liberal radicals, the fragile ascendancy of Poincaré and his alliance policy, or the campaign waged by Sukhumlinov against Kakovtsev. After Vladimir Kakovtsev's fall from office in January 1914, according to the unpublished memoir of a political insider, Tsar Nicholas II offered his post in the first instance to the deeply conservative Pyotr N. Durnovo, a forceful and determined man who was adamantly opposed to Balkan entanglements of any kind. But Durnovo turned the post down, and it passed instead to Garemykin, whose weakness allowed Krivosheyn and the military command to wield disproportionate influence in the councils of July 1914. It would be a mistake to hang too much on this detail, but it draws our attention to the place of short-range, contingent realignments in shaping the conditions under which the crisis of 1914 unfolded. This, in turn, made the system as a whole more opaque and unpredictable, feeding a pervasive mood of mutual distrust, even within the respective alliances, a development that was dangerous for peace. Levels of trust between the Russian and British leaderships were relatively low by 1914, and they were getting lower. But this did not diminish the readiness of the British Foreign Office to accept a European war on terms set by Russia. On the contrary, it reinforced the case for intervention. The same can be said for the Franco-Russian alliance. Doubts about its future had the effect on both sides of heightening, rather than muting, the readiness to risk conflict. Fluctuations in power relations within each government, coupled with swiftly changing objective conditions, in turn produced the policy oscillations and ambiguous messaging that were such a crucial feature of the pre-war crises. Indeed, it is not clear that the term policy is always appropriate in the pre-1914 context, given the looseness and ambiguity of many of the commitments involved. Whether Russia or Germany had a Balkan policy in the years 1912-14 is questionable. What we see instead is a multiplicity of initiatives, scenarios, and attitudes whose overall trend is sometimes hard to discern. Within the respective state executives, the changeability of power relations also meant that those entrusted with formulating policy did so under considerable domestic pressure, not so much from the press or public opinion or industrial or financial lobbies, as from adversaries within their own elites and governments. And this, too, heightened the sense of urgency besetting decision-makers in the summer of 1914. We need to distinguish between the objective factors acting on the decision-makers and the stories they told themselves and each other about what they thought they were doing and why they were doing it. All the key actors in our story filtered the world through narratives that were built from pieces of experience, glued together with fears, projections, and interests masquerading as maxims. In Austria, the story of a nation of youthful bandits and regicides endlessly provoking and goading a patient elderly neighbor got in the way of a cool-headed assessment of how to manage relations with Belgrade. In Serbia, fantasies of victimhood and oppression by a rapacious, all-powerful Habsburg Empire did the same in reverse. In Germany, a dark vision of future invasions and partitions bedeviled decision-making in the summer of 1914. And the Russian saga of repeated humiliations at the hands of the Central Powers had a similar impact, at once distorting the past and clarifying the present. Most important of all was the widely trafficked narrative of Austria-Hungary's historically necessary decline, which, having gradually replaced an older set of assumptions about Austria's role as a fulcrum of stability in Central and Eastern Europe, disinhibited Vienna's enemies, undermining the notion that Austria-Hungary, like every other great power, possessed interests that it had the right robustly to defend. That the Balkan setting was central to the outbreak of war may seem self-evident, given the location of the assassinations that started the crisis. But two points in particular deserve emphasis. The first is that the Balkan Wars recalibrated the relationships among the greater and lesser powers in dangerous ways. In the eyes of both the Austrian and the Russian leaderships, the struggle to control events on the Balkan Peninsula took on a new and more threatening aspect, especially during the winter crisis of 1912-13. One consequence was the Balkanization of the Franco-Russian alliance. France and Russia, at different paces and for different reasons, constructed a geopolitical trigger along the Austro-Serbian frontier. The Balkan inception scenario was not a policy or a plan or plot that steadily matured over time, nor was there any necessary or linear relationship between the positions adopted in 1912 and 1913 and the outbreak of war in the following year. It was not that the Balkan inception scenario, which was in effect a Serbian inception scenario, drove Europe forwards towards the war that actually happened in 1914, but rather the other way round, that it supplied the conceptual framework within which the crisis was interpreted once it had broken out. Russia and France thereby tied the fortunes of two of the world's greatest powers in highly asymmetrical fashion to the uncertain destiny of a turbulent and intermittently violent state. For Austria-Hungary, whose regional security arrangements were ruined by the Balkan Wars, the Sarajevo murders were not a pretext for a pre-existing policy of invasion and warfare. They were a transformative event, charged with real and symbolic menace. It is easy from the perspective of the 21st century to say that Vienna should have resolved the issues arising from the assassinations through calm bilateral negotiations with Belgrade, but in the setting of 1914 this was not a credible option. Nor, for that matter, was Sir Edward Grey's half-hearted proposal of four-power mediation, which was founded upon a partisan indifference to the power political realities of Austria-Hungary's situation. It was not just that the Serbian authorities were partly unwilling and partly unable to suppress the irredentist activity that had given rise to the assassinations in the first place. It was also that Serbia's friends did not concede to Vienna the right to incorporate in its demands on Belgrade a means of monitoring and enforcing compliance. They rejected such demands on the ground that they were irreconcilable with Serbian sovereignty. There are parallels here with the debate that took place within the UN Security Council in October 2011 over a proposal, favoured by the NATO states, that sanctions should be imposed on the Assad regime in Syria to prevent further massacres of that country's dissident citizens. Against this proposal, the Russian representative argued that the idea reflected an inappropriately confrontational approach that was typical of the Western powers, while the Chinese representative argued that sanctions were inappropriate because they were irreconcilable with Syrian sovereignty. Where does this leave the question of culpability? By asserting that Germany and her allies were morally responsible for the outbreak of war, Article 231 of the Versailles Peace Treaty ensured that questions of culpability would remain at or near the center of the debate over the war's origins. The blame game has never lost its appeal. The most influential articulation of this tradition is the Fischer thesis, shorthand for a bundle of arguments elaborated in the 1960s by Fritz Fischer, Immanuel Geiss, and a score of younger German colleagues who identified Germany as the power chiefly culpable in the outbreak of war. According to this view, leaving aside the many variations within the Fischer school, the Germans did not stumble or slither into war. They chose it. Worse, they planned it in advance, in the hope of breaking out of their European isolation and launching a bid for world power. Recent studies of the resulting Fischer controversy have highlighted the links between this debate and the fraught process by which German intellectuals came to terms with the contaminating moral legacy of the Nazi era, and Fischer's arguments have been subjected to criticism on many points. Nonetheless, a diluted version of the Fischer thesis still dominates in studies of Germany's road to war. Do we really need to make the case against a single guilty state, or to rank the states according to their respective share in responsibility for the outbreak of war? In one classical study from the origins literature, Paul Kennedy remarked that it is flaccid to dodge the search for a culprit by blaming all or none of the belligerent states. A stiffer approach, Kennedy implies, ought not to shrink from pointing the finger. The problem with a blame-centered account is not that one may end up blaming the wrong party. It is rather that accounts structured around blame come with built-in assumptions. They tend, firstly, to presume that in conflictual interactions, one protagonist must ultimately be right and the other wrong. Were the Serbs wrong to seek to unify Serbdom? Were the Austrians wrong to insist on the independence of Albania? Was one of these enterprises more wrong than the other? The question is meaningless. A further drawback of prosecutorial narratives is that they narrow the field of vision by focusing on the political temperament and initiatives of one particular state rather than on multilateral processes of interaction. Then there is the problem that the quest for blame predisposes the investigator to construe the actions of decision-makers as planned and driven by a coherent intention. You have to show that someone willed war as well as caused it. In its extreme form, this mode of procedure produces conspiratorial narratives in which a coterie of powerful individuals, like velvet-jacketed Bond villains, controls events from behind the scene in accordance with a malevolent plan. There is no denying the moral satisfaction delivered by such narratives, and it is not, of course, logically impossible that war came about in this manner in the summer of 1914. But the view expounded in this book is that such arguments are not supported by the evidence. The outbreak of war in 1914 is not an Agatha Christie drama, at the end of which we will discover the culprit standing over a corpse in the conservatory with a smoking pistol. There is no smoking gun in this story, or rather, there is one in the hands of every major character. Viewed in this light, the outbreak of war was a tragedy, not a crime. Acknowledging this does not mean that we should minimize the belligerence and imperialist paranoia of the Austrian and German policymakers that rightly absorbed the attention of Fritz Fischer and his historiographical allies. But the Germans were not the only imperialists, and not the only ones to succumb to paranoia. The crisis that brought war in 1914 was the fruit of a shared political culture. But it was also multipolar and genuinely interactive. That is what makes it the most complex event of modern times, and that is why the debate over the origins of the First World War continues, one century after Gavrilo Princip fired those two fatal shots on Franz Josef Street. One thing is clear. None of the prizes for which the politicians of 1914 contended was worth the cataclysm that followed. Did the protagonists understand how high the stakes were? It used to be thought that Europeans subscribed to the deluded belief that the next continental conflict would be a short, sharp cabinet war of the 18th century type. The men would be home before Christmas, as the saying went. More recently, the prevalence of this short war illusion has been called into question. The German Schlieffen plan was predicated on a massive, lightning-fast strike into France, but even within Schlieffen's own staff, there were voices warning that the next war would bring not quick victories, but rather a tedious and bloody crawling forward step by step. Helmut von Moltke hoped that a European war, if it broke out, would be resolved swiftly, but he also conceded that it might drag on for years, wreaking immeasurable ruin. British Prime Minister Herbert Asquith wrote of the approach of Armageddon in the fourth week of July 1914. French and Russian generals spoke of a war of extermination and the extinction of civilization. They knew it, but did they really feel it? This is perhaps one of the differences between the years before 1914 and the years after 1945. In the 1950s and 60s, decision-makers and the general public alike grasped in a visceral way the meaning of nuclear war. Images of the mushroom clouds over Hiroshima and Nagasaki entered the nightmares of ordinary citizens. As a consequence, the greatest arms race in human history never culminated in nuclear war between the superpowers. It was different before 1914. In the minds of many statesmen, the hope for a short war and the fear of a long one seem, as it were, to have cancelled each other out, holding at bay a fuller appreciation of the risks. In March 1913, a journalist writing for the Figaro reported on a series of lectures recently given in Paris by the leading lights of French military medicine. Among the speakers was Professor Jacques-Ambroise Monprofit, who had just returned from a special mission to the military hospitals of Greece and Serbia, where he had helped to establish better standards of military surgery. Monprofit observed that the wounds caused by the French cannon, sold to Balkan states before the outbreak of the First Balkan War, were not merely the most numerous, but also horrifically grave, with crushed bones, lacerated tissues, and shattered chests and skulls. So terrible was the resulting suffering that one prominent expert in military surgery, Professor Antoine Depage, proposed an international embargo on the future use of such arms in battle. "We understand the generosity of his motivation," the journalist commented. "But if we must expect to be outnumbered one day on the field of battle, Then it is as well that our enemies know that we have such weapons to defend ourselves with, weapons that are to be feared. The article closed with the declaration that France should congratulate herself both on the horrific force of her arms and on possessing a medical organization that we may confidently describe as marvelous. We can find such glib reflections wherever we look in pre-war Europe. In this sense, the protagonists of 1914 were sleepwalkers, watchful but unseeing, haunted by dreams, yet blind to the reality of the horror they were about to bring into the world. This concludes The Sleepwalkers by Christopher Clark, narrated by Derek Perkins. Copyright 2012 by Christopher Clark. This unabridged audiobook is produced by arrangement with Harper, an imprint of HarperCollins Publishers, and was produced in the year 2014 by Tantor Media, Incorporated, which holds the copyright thereto. Please visit Tantor.com for more information on our growing library of unabridged audiobooks and to take advantage of special offers. Or call toll-free 877-7-TANTOR to request a catalogue.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.